This is Ann Cox, and welcome to Moving Mindfully. Here we delve into the psychology behind physical activity, and we talk about the many different paths to getting the most satisfaction and enjoyment out of moving our bodies. I also try to connect the research or the science behind physical activity to the actual practice itself. Let's begin today's episode. Hi, everyone. So today on the podcast, I'm talking with Dr. Christy Greenleaf. She is a professor of kinesiology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and her work focuses on psychosocial aspects of weight, physical activity, body image, disordered eating, among other things. She is particularly interested in weight bias, which is negative attitudes and stereotypes toward individuals who appear to be overweight, and how weight bias manifests itself within physical activity settings. Christy and I are both in the world of sport and exercise psychology, which is one of the subdisciplines of kinesiology. And so I've admired her work kind of from afar, and I've kept up with her research because we have some things in common. But unfortunately, I've rarely talked to Christy in person and actually had relatively few interactions with her personally. So I'm really excited to talk to her today. So we're going to talk a little bit today about Christy's research, about her own experiences related to physical activity and body image, and hopefully, as always, weave in a little bit of the research and a little bit of personal experience, and hopefully get some advice and practical implications from Christy as well. So I think the first question I would like to ask you is just if you can tell us a little bit about your own physical activity history and background.
Sure. So my early experiences with physical activity and sport were really in figure skating. And that's been the activity I've really engaged in throughout my whole life. And as a child, we lived in a very cold climate in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And so my parents would take me skating just for fun, something to do. And I happened to see an ice show and really loved all the figure skaters. I loved the drama and the excitement and the performance, and that they twirled around so fast that their skirts went out. And so I started taking skating lessons and really just loved the feel of being on the ice. I loved going fast. I loved the cold air. I loved jumping and spinning, and just really liked, especially as a young child, competing. I liked performing. And as I started to get a little bit older, probably as a preteen and then definitely as a teenager, noticed that my body shape was pretty different from a lot of other high-level skaters. So as people can probably imagine, you know, you think about the figure skaters you see on TV, very thin, lean, petite, and that body shape was really thought of as being advantageous for skating performance. So I started to get some pressure to lose weight, and I definitely internalized that as well and became pretty dissatisfied with my body shape and size. I thought my legs were too big and my butt got too big, and I just wasn't thin enough. And I continued to skate, but did not enjoy performing quite as much, did not enjoy competing, and just really focused on the parts I liked about skating in terms of practicing and trying to learn new skills and the challenge of that. So I think those early experiences definitely shaped the kinds of things I'm interested in now, working in academia and doing research.
Mm-hmm. I have several follow-up questions. First is a comment. I think it's so cool that you watched like an ice show and thought, I can do that. Because I too thought that was super cool, but never would have imagined trying it. But we each select different things that we try. And that's a whole interesting story in and of itself. What age was it where you started first having the concerns? And then was it the same age, or what age was it then that the enjoyment started to kind of go away a little bit, where it wasn't quite as much fun? When was that happening for you?
Well, you know, what I distinctly remember, and it's kind of coming back to me in a more concrete memory now that we're talking about it, but when I was 8, I started Weight Watchers to try to lose weight for skating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the time, that seemed logical and reasonable. Looking back on it, I, you know, would have a different opinion about that. But I don't remember actually being very dissatisfied with my body at that age, other than thinking I needed to be thinner or lighter for skating.
Mm-hmm.
When I really noticed kind of the body dissatisfaction increasing was probably more when I was, I would say 13 or 14, and just really being unhappy. And it's interesting. I was unhappy in part because of what I thought it was having a negative impact on skating, but also that it was really difficult to find clothes that fit, particularly pants or jeans, and that shopping was a horrible experience.
Oh, that's so interesting, too. Just that clothing, I was just giving that example in my undergraduate class the other day where it's become really apparent to me in my adult life how much the availability of clothing sizes impacts your body image.
Absolutely.
It's a little bit of a side note, but I've started working with some folks in apparel and merchandising, just serving on some thesis committees that are related to body image. And for me, as somebody who's 6 feet tall, it really impacted me. And then when companies came out with tall clothing sizes, I think it's one of the factors that actually helped me accept my body. You know, there were many factors as I got older, but
sure. This
idea that they were not only tall, but then they tended to have a little bit broader shoulder, and that companies were making clothes that were suited to me better, it meant something. Because for years and years, I just thought, oh, something about, like, if I lose enough weight, I'll fit into these sizes. And that just wasn't going to work.
Right. Yeah, I totally can relate to that. I mean, not in terms of being 6 feet tall, but just in having a body shape that, you know, really didn't fit with what manufacturers were designing and selling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. So to what extent, it's interesting, I mean, I talk about my history too, and it's all in retrospect, and we know that these memories are, you know, filtered through so very many different lenses and things that have happened in our life, but, you know, did it occur to you, do you remember it occurring to you that the weight in some way was inhibiting performance, that, like, you didn't feel good, or do you feel like it was really external pressure? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think maybe even less, it was less that I really thought it was negatively impacting my performance, like in terms of my skill, and probably more strongly that I just felt like I didn't look like a figure skater.
Right.
I didn't have the right look. And so, you know, coaches, and not all of my coaches, but a few, would have me do things like, you know, write down every single thing I ate, or they wanted to weigh me. And none of my friends had to do any of that. And we were all skating just as much. And I was on this really, you know, just kind of self-imposed restrictive eating pattern because I was worried about them evaluating what I was submitting to them. And, you know, all those kinds of things that go along with that in terms of, are they going to believe what I'm writing down? Because it doesn't seem to make sense. Like, I should be losing weight and I'm not, and I'm skating all these hours a day. Yeah.
Wow. So for the listeners, you know, in the research world, we call figure skating an aesthetic sport, right? And we know that aesthetic sport participation can be associated with more negative body image, body dissatisfaction, eating disorders, and those kinds of things. So I'm not in that world, and I've never, you know, been coached in that world. But I'm curious, maybe appearance is of utmost importance in that sport, but I'm wondering if the coaches ever differentiated between focusing on, this skill versus appearance. Was it really all about appearance, or from the coach's perspective, you know, or was it about function, that if you lose this weight, you really will perform better? Or in an aesthetic sport, are those of equal importance because the aesthetic is part of the scoring? That's a lot of little questions in there, but can you help us understand that better?
Sure. You know, and I'm thinking too that the way in which figure skating is judged now is different than how it was judged when I was competing. And so now they use the international judging system, which is very much focused on skill and technical performance. I think there are still components of appearance as it might relate to presentation on the ice that would impact kind of, you know, how judges or others are evaluating a skater's performance. When I was skating, it was on the old 6.0 scale that people might remember from a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very subjective. And so I think there was a great deal of emphasis placed on having the right look.
Yeah.
And having the right body shape or physique. And so I don't really remember coaches specifically linking weight to performance, like, oh, you'd be able to, you know, this jump would be easier or this spin combination would be better if you were lighter. But it was, I think, a little more vague in terms mm-hmm. of how they would talk about it. And then, you know, just as someone who wanted to do well and make my coaches proud and, you know, get better, I sort of interpreted it as, oh, this is what I need to do to become a better skater.
Yeah, that does help. I'm curious, given your experience and also some of the changes that you noted that are taking place, would you encourage young girls to pursue these aesthetic sports? How do you feel about that?
That is such a good question, right? Because there's no easy answer.
Yeah.
And there's so much individual variation between people that might participate in the sport and then variation among coaches and coaching styles. I think to some extent, coaches are probably a little more knowledgeable and aware of how their communication with athletes might impact things like eating and body image, maybe than when I was skating as a younger person. But you still see evidence of high level skaters dealing with body related issues. So just recently, within the past year, a top figure skater named Gracie Gold had a performance that was a little bit underwhelming. And in her conversations with press afterwards, she made some comments indicating that she was not in the shape she needed to be in. And the way she phrased it sort of made people think she felt like she was too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here's this top level skater who is, as are all top level figure skaters, they are tiny people. If you see them in person, they are just petite people mm-hmm. for the most part. So then you wonder about, you know, all these skaters that look up to her and thinking, okay, here's this high level skater who's had a lot of success in the past. And, you know, there are high hopes for her, commenting that she's not in the shape she needs to be in, and she took it too easy over the summer and just ate too much. And, you know, kids look up to that and think, oh, maybe I should watch what I'm eating and be concerned about my body weight and shape and how that's impacting my performance. So I think it's still, even though some things have changed in terms of scoring and evaluation, I do think issues related to body weight and shape are still pretty central in figure skating. My guess is that in other similar kinds of sports like gymnastics, it's the same, right? There is still the belief that having a smaller physique is advantageous for performance.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in terms of, you know, would I encourage girls to go into those kinds of sports? I think if the kind of social environment is such that it focuses on function and challenge and skill, then that's great. I would be a little concerned if we're putting girls in situations where they're getting a lot of messages about weight and appearance, and that those things are somehow more important than
mm-hmm.
being strong and being fit and being courageous when you're out on the ice and all those kinds of things that we would, you know, want girls to learn from participating in sport.
Yeah, and we could add to that list diving and dance and cheerleading. And
yeah.
And what always struck me as sort of odd is like how we put gymnastics and figure skating in the clearly feminine category, right? Not only aesthetic,
right.
but feminine.
Right.
And how those sports, to me, require more power and more strength than anything I can imagine.
Maybe except for powerlifting. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's such a paradox in a way. And I worry, just I have an 8-year-old daughter, and when you hear little girls get interested in feminine physical activities, and I wonder, and those are the questions I ask myself. Well, it's not like in and of itself that skating or gymnastics are negative at all, but what messaging are they going to get about their bodies? Yeah, I mean, that's what I ask myself.
And certainly that was very similar to my experience. I mean, when I was very young and saw this ice show, I loved the sparkles. I loved, all the fanciness of the show. I mean, that's really what drew me into the sport. So that is a tough sort of thing to navigate, I think.
Yeah, well, let's shift gears because I want to hear, we're going to get to your research in a little bit, but I really want to hear what has happened later in your life as you went from, I love the feeling of twirling and spinning fast and how this feels, to really going, kind of downhill and increasing the emphasis on aesthetics, which, decreased your enjoyment of the activity. And then what has happened for you in adulthood?
Sure. So after I got out of high school, I actually skated in ice capades for a year. And that was a very interesting experience that definitely has impacted what I do now. And so going into ice capades as an 18-year-old, I had worked, and they have very strict weight requirements, or they did when I was in it. I worked very hard to get my weight as low as possible going into that. So I was doing things I would not encourage other people to do because they were not healthy behaviors, but it made sense to me at the time. Like, I'm going to do what I have to do to achieve this goal. And so in ice capades, they would give you what they call a set weight, and it was basically based on your height and how you looked. So they would just tell you, this is what you need to weigh. And every week you would get weighed in front of everybody. And if you were over your set weight, you got fined, and your fine got put on your sort of dressing area so that everybody could see you got fined.
Oh my
And
gosh.
if you were fined enough times, you could get fired.
Wow.
So I went into that experience so excited because I really did, and I still do. I loved ice skating, and I thought this is gonna be so great. And I really was very naive. I thought, everybody was gonna be also super excited about ice skating and, into health and wellness. And what I found was that a lot of people smoked to manage their weight. A lot of people drank their dinner instead of eating dinner. And some folks did engage in some, really harmful behaviors like self-induced vomiting and taking diuretics. And I remember one person taking some medication to make herself throw up. So those things were very eye-opening. I did not expect that. And what I saw was that that was not the world I wanted to be a part of. And it really did take a lot of the joy out of skating. So my skating involvement decreased a little bit after that, but I ended up, when I was in college, getting involved in synchronized skating, which is team skating. It's kind of like synchronized swimming, where you do formations and that kind of thing, but it's just on ice. And what I found was that I really enjoyed that quite a bit because I got to still compete a bit, I got to perform. But it wasn't everyone looking at me on the ice, right? I was out there with 15 or 16 other skaters, and we were all supposed to, move in unison and sort of look as one. So I really liked that, and over time started to really appreciate that I was still able to be involved in my sport, that I was strong and fit and healthy, that I could still do some of the skills I could do when I was a kid. And as I've aged, that still holds true. Like, now I really love that my legs are so strong and are muscular, and I love that my body lets me do the things I want to do. Last year, I started taking learn to speed skate classes, which has been super fun and challenging, and definitely makes me, again, just appreciate my body and what it can do, not how it looks.
What do you think were the defining factors that helped you make that shift?
That's a good question. I think part of it is gaining some expertise in the sort of factors that contribute to body shape and weight, and that learning that it's not 100% my responsibility, or that my body is infinitely malleable, that I should be able to shape it if I just worked hard enough or wanted it enough, that I should be able to create this, physique that conforms with kind of social and sport norms. So I think just getting educated about some of that. And then I think too, just getting older, being less concerned about what other people think. I think, part of that just comes with getting older and gaining perspective. And I guess recognizing to some extent that most people are way more concerned about themselves than they are concerned about what you look like.
So true.
So, I should engage in the activities I enjoy and not worry about it.
Yeah, I think for me, I always wonder that because my shift really came in my 30s, and up until that point, I was still, even though I enjoyed physical activity, it was still very much in my mind, let's get to the gym and burn calories sort of thing, like a little bit of guilt or just not feeling good about myself if I missed a day. Just still more of a pushing myself a little bit rather than truly enjoying it. And for me, I think the shift, I always wondered how much of it was age and how much of it, is other things. And I think it's both. I agree with you about the perspective. And without a doubt, for most people, it starts to get a little less important. But I also don't think that's like a normative development because there are women who obsess about their weight and appearance for their whole life. And so I think for me, it was learning something new. And that's what you talk about with like your speed skating is really turning the focus back onto gaining feelings of competence and feelings of function. So for me, that's been yoga. And it was just so thrilling. When I started it 4 years ago, I felt like I was a kid in sport again, experiencing sensations that were new to me for the first time, like going upside down or holding a crow or whatever it is, that were novel and really satisfying internally. And I was like, oh, cool. And you feel yourself getting better. And I really noted, I was like, I haven't really experienced this since I was a competitive athlete, and probably more so long before that, because when I was in my latter years, like you, I was really obsessed with body image as well. So that was taking away from, the focus on function. So, yeah, I think this aspect that you talk about, the appreciation for what your strong muscles can do for you and how that contributes to the way you feel engaging in physical activity is a pretty huge thing.
Yeah, absolutely. My experience with learning speed skating sounds very similar to your experience with yoga. I mean, there is something about kind of a new challenge and seeing improvement and going like, oh, I can do this. I mean, it is about perceived competence. Like, I am able to master this challenge. There's
Right.
something very empowering about that.
And I think we lose that as adults. Many of us, now, so many people, especially in our field, when you go to conferences, a lot of people in our field are into new challenges, new physical
Right.
activity pursuits, and they're training for marathons or they're doing rock climbing or any number of things. So we're kind of an anomaly. But I think what I worry about is the average adult who goes, I guess I just go to the gym now. I guess I'll just run or lift weights or and
Right.
even some of the more HIIT training or whatever it is, and not to knock any of those forms of physical activity specifically, but to go, have you really kind of explored to see what lights you up? Just what really makes you feel good in your body. And I'm glad I figured it out when I did. I'm like, God, I wish I'd figured it out sooner. But from college to my mid-30s, I really was just kind of doing the gym thing and it was fine. But I didn't have the same level of satisfaction, empowerment, just feeling capable in my body that I do now. Yeah. Are you ready to shift a little bit here? Yeah, so we've talked a little bit about confidence, and then and I think we've hit on some practical implications too for young girls. So now I'm going to leave the aesthetic sport world a little bit to ask you about your work on weight stigma. So I know that's been one of the things that you've been researching. What can you tell us about why you're interested in it and what you're learning?
Yeah, so weight-related stigma really came into my world when I was in Texas, and a colleague of mine introduced me to a researcher named Heather Chambliss, who was doing some work on weight stigma. And I really was not familiar with the concept. I mean, it made sense once I kind of read about it, but I hadn't really been tuned into that idea. And what was sort of interesting was I was sort of personally curious about it because I felt like in our field, I saw that. Like, as I was reading more about it and better understood kind of the concept of, weight stigma, so these sort of negative associations or assumptions we might make when we look at someone and assume or think that they're larger than they should be. We look at someone and we think they're fat or we think they're overweight or we just think they're somehow too big. And I was sort of curious about it because I felt like in sport and exercise psychology, I sort of saw that sometimes, like that people with bodies that did not look fit or athletic, were somehow given less prestige or not thought to be as competent or as knowledgeable. So that really just made me kind of, curious about weight stigma. And as I had some opportunities to talk more and do a little bit of work with Heather, I started thinking more about how this might impact people's health behaviors. So, if you are experiencing weight-related stigma or bias, to what extent does that impact your physical activity behaviors? And so, when I was in Texas, we did a series of studies looking at middle school students, and we were looking at their physical health and their psychosocial health. And part of what we looked at was weight-related teasing. So the extent to which middle school students were reporting that they were teased or made fun of or picked on because of their body weight or shape. And what we found was that experiences of weight-related stigma were associated with higher levels of depressive symptoms, and that self-esteem in particular seemed to impact that relationship. So one of the things that is sort of interesting is even though kids might experience weight-related stigma via teasing, if we can help them develop a strong sense of self and self-worth, that can offset some of the risk for depressive symptoms that might come along with that initial experience of teasing. So
Yeah, interesting.
that's been sort of one thread of research in that area. And then more recently, here at UW-Milwaukee, a colleague and I have been doing some work with our students critically analyzing The Biggest Loser. So one analysis we did was looking at the portrayal of various weight loss and weight management strategies on the television show. And so we did a content analysis looking at how much of the time of the broadcast were contestants shown trying to change their physical activity behaviors and exercising and talking about exercise versus doing things related to nutrition and eating as a strategy for weight change. And what we found was that this is probably not too surprising to anybody that's ever seen the show. The majority of the time was geared toward physical activity. Not much of what was broadcast really showed things related to changing eating behaviors. And when you look at research in terms of weight management, that's really not an accurate portrayal of what is effective over time in particular. And then our most recent study related to The Biggest Loser is looking at the way in which the trainers treat the contestants within the exercise portions of the show. So when they're in the gym on the ranch, how are the trainers talking to and treating the contestants? And we're sort of curious to see what types of weight stigmatizing behaviors we might see. And it was pretty disturbing, actually, when we did the analysis. We found pretty frequent verbal aggression directed toward the contestant. So yelling at them, threatening them, like if you touch the handles on the treadmill one more time, I'm gonna break your arms off. And a lot of threats related to the trainer perceiving that the contestant was being lazy. And if they continued, they were just going to add on more time, or they were somehow going to punish the rest of the contestants for that person's, what they perceived as laziness.
Right.
There were some instances of actual physical aggression. So trainers, especially in situations where a contestant might have like fallen or been down on the ground and trying to get up, the trainer pushing them back down. Or in one instance, contestants were doing wall squats. So they had their backs against the wall and were in a, had their knees at 90 degrees. And the trainer walked across their thighs just to give them a little added weight. a lot of instances showing that the contestants sort of in unflattering lights. So showing the contestants throwing up, falling off the treadmill, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of just stereotype endorsement. So again, things related to perceiving that the contestants are simply just lazy and don't know what hard work is. And if they did, they wouldn't be in this situation. So that's been very interesting and a bit disturbing.
I'm so glad you're doing this work. This is so exciting. What is your kind of big takeaway from what all of what you just described?
Well, I would say in terms of The Biggest Loser, although it's a very popular show and it seems as though some people report finding that motivating, like that portrayal of individuals sort of being motivating, it really sends very dangerous messages to a mass audience, right? It sends a message that the only way to effectively motivate people we think of as fat is to be mean to them and to scream and yell at them and swear at them, and that people in that situation deserve everything that comes their way. So people we perceive of as fat, they deserve all the consequences, the social consequences, the physical consequences, because we assume they've simply done it to themselves.
Right.
So I think those are really dangerous messages. And from kind of a health promotion or public health perspective, it really, that mentality is completely ineffective. Right? If we want to help people engage in behavior change related to increasing activity and increasing kind of nutritious eating, those strategies actually do the opposite. So when people experience weight-related stigma and bias, avoidance of physical activity and binge eating are two of the most commonly reported coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
So it's really ineffective.
Oh, thank you so much for bringing that up. You know, I struggle with teaching my undergraduate students this each year. You probably do too. This, there's a couple layers to this. Number one is that with the, well, one of the things, this might be a piece of the weight-based stigma, is that we make this mistake of equating weight with health. And
yes. It,
even our kinesiology students do, right?
Yes.
Like they really, they have to get past that, and it takes work to think about, what does health look like? Well, guess what? It doesn't look like something. Yeah, so that's one level of it, is that we're making a lot of assumptions, right, about what that person does in their life to look that way. And then what I really want to hit on is what you said, like the Biggest Loser style, is we're really sending the message of what you're doing, this is wrong. Everything about you, you need to change this, right? And we're going to forcefully change something about your behavior and your appearance. And God, I had a student the other day bring this up, and it was a great point. You know, you hear this all the time. Well, doesn't somebody need to feel bad about themselves to change? Don't they need to feel bad? Don't they need to realize that they need to lose weight? What would you say to that?
I would say no. Emphatically no. People don't need to feel bad about themselves. That's actually something that inhibits behavior change. And it sort of goes back to what we talked about earlier in terms of like feeling empowered, right? In terms of our own sport experiences, it's when people feel confident, like I can do this. And when they feel empowered, I have the ability to create change in my environment, to engage in these behaviors. And when they're supported for that, that's much more likely to create the kind of behavior change we're interested in and that can be sustained over the long term. That's one thing I really sometimes I'm concerned about, is especially with these types of weight loss competitions, it's all very short term.
Right.
These things they have people doing are not sustainable. And if we're thinking about helping people live healthier lives, which we assume will then mean happier lives, we have to help them adopt behaviors they can maintain over time. They can do when things are tough, when the situation is not optimal.
Right. Yeah, and you'll be so. I have several thoughts I want to bring in here. I think a big piece of this, and something we're doing some research on in our lab, which may actually be a connection for a potential collaboration, Christy. I have a thought.
Great.
Is that we're doing a lot of work on self-compassion, which has an inherent element of acceptance and helps you accept things you're struggling with wherever you are. Like, it's okay, just acceptance. And I'm reading the Carl Rogers quote on my office door right now, which relates to this idea. So he's, one of the fathers of humanist psychology for the listeners out there. And the quote on my door says, "The curious paradox is that just when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change." And I have to say, I don't think I understood that until quite a ways into my adulthood. But after I finally experienced it, it made it more real to me. And so we're really, with the weight stigma, I see such a connection. You talked about self-worth. If they have self-worth, the teasing may not have as big of an impact. And I'm curious, what about self-compassion? So if you learn to use that as a tool to work through some of these difficult feelings that do come up because of weight bias or teasing or whatever it might be, I think that could be really helpful.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned earlier too about the challenge of trying to communicate some of these ideas with undergraduate students in kinesiology. And we face the same thing because that connection between weight and health is so strong in our students' minds, right? And we have talked a bit about trying to develop a class based on the health at every size approach. And I think you have done that or have done some work in that area.
No, maybe not directly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what made me think of it is this idea of self-compassion that you mentioned. So health at every size, if people aren't familiar with that, it is this really great non-weight based approach to health promotion and really advocates for disconnecting weight and health, and that people's bodies naturally come in a variety of shapes and sizes, that moving your body should be pleasurable and enjoyable and not solely for the pursuit of burning calories or losing weight, and that eating should also be pleasurable, and that we should learn to listen to our internal cues of hunger and satiety. And I think a big part of the health at every size philosophy is grounded in this idea of self-acceptance and self-compassion, and that is a really, I think, different way for people to think about what does it mean to be healthy, right? And you said it's not how you look. It doesn't really have anything to do with how you look. It's the behaviors that you're engaging in that support your overall health and well-being.
Right. I interviewed the founder of Curvy Yoga. Her name is Anna Guest-Jelly, and she has a really nice online platform. You'll be really interested to listen to that one. And she talks a lot about, as the name might suggest, she's has a bigger body relative to a lot of people you see out there teaching yoga. And she really, what I loved, and she has a podcast as well. And I started listening and following her. And what I loved about her messaging was that it was right on with what we're talking about and with the research, but she's doing it as a practitioner, And she talked about this idea of, we know about intuitive eating now quite a bit, like thinking about what your body needs and when you're full and when you're hungry. And she talks about intuitive moving, which I'm really getting more and more interested in. And the idea is that, contrary to the Biggest Loser, right, when you push yourself through no matter what, you learn how to listen to what your body needs. And some days that means you don't do much. And other days it means you feel like walking to work and whatever it is, because if you really truly tap into that over time, and pairing it with the intuitive eating makes it more powerful, right? You're really listening to all the needs of your body. You end up moving more over a longer period of time. So she's addressed some people are like, well, if I really listen to my body, I'm just going to lay on the couch all day. And actually, what she's found is that's not true. And the more that you move, the more that you want to move. And so when she was able to make the shift in her life to really intuitively moving, it just meant more movement overall. Over a long period of time, right? Not on a daily, maybe not on a weekly basis, but across a lifetime.
That's so great to hear of practitioners, right, embracing and really utilizing some of those concepts that we study and research in their practice, because that's such a nice link between, what we think of as being important and what the data shows us versus, what is someone doing that's really impacting the lives and experiences of people. So that's really great. Thanks for sharing that.
That's really why I wanted to do this podcast because I feel like the majority of what we see from the fitness industry is not the healthiest, you know? And I was just kind of pondering, how do we get these messages out more effectively? And maybe this is one small way. We'll see. So before we finish this, I think you've answered all of my big questions. This has been absolutely wonderful. Is there anything else that you would like to share with listeners? Anything you're working on or any last messages?
I'll just briefly share something that relates to what you mentioned early on about some of your work with folks in apparel, textiles earlier. So we've got some work going on right now looking at plus size exercise apparel and cost, availability, color options, things like
Great.
that, in comparison to quote unquote regular size exercise apparel. And we surveyed women, about 180 women that self-reported wearing a size 14 in the US or equivalent, or larger, and that were physically active. And we're really curious about, like, what is their shopping experience like? So are they shopping in line or on store in stores? And it was pretty split. And then what's their experience like? Like, are they able to find what they're looking for? Do they think clothes are fashionable and functional? How does that influence their physical activity behaviors and how they feel about their bodies while they're being physically active? And we're still in the early stages of analyzing that, but it's really interesting to see some of the raw data, especially to responses to some open-ended questions about, like, what would you want retailers to know, or what would you want designers to know about, women that wear a larger size exercise apparel? And a lot of the comments had to do with function and fashion. Like, people want some options that are fashionable so that they look and feel like everyone else exercising. And it was just really, I think it'll be neat when we sort of put it all together to see how the pieces of the puzzle fit together. But I think that the options available seem to be increasing. Nike just came out with saying they will be having larger sizes in their exercise apparel, which I think is really
Oh,
interesting.
wow.
Meijer has an ad campaign. I don't know if you have Meijer's. It's a big, like a Target or a Walmart kind of store. Yeah, so they just have an ad campaign now indicating that their plus size clothing will now be integrated into all the other clothing instead of being in a separate section. So I think, it's sort of interesting to see how the apparel kind of industry is, to some extent, maybe listening to some consumer demands. I'm sure most of it's profit driven, but if it provides people, with resources that will help them feel good about being physically active, I'm all for it.
That's right. I was just on a thesis committee that looked at plus size apparel. So I heard about all of this, like where is it located in the store and what pros and cons of integrating versus not. And it's really interesting. But the bottom line is, if you're not carrying those sizes, you're not meeting the needs of this country. I mean, in a huge way. So, and oh, it's just so fascinating. Just as a small anecdote, my My mom and I went on a vacation a few years ago, and it was at Wallawa Lake in Oregon, which is a really cold lake, and we were going to do paddle boarding. And I had gotten into, I love this idea that like swim tights were becoming popular. And I love the idea because it just felt like you could be free and a little bit warmer and do what you wanted to do. And then my mom got them too. And I just felt like it made her a lot more confident to get out there on a paddleboard, stand up in front of people because she had the apparel that worked, right? That you're not pulling at and trying to adjust and feeling self-conscious in. And that's so important. So just what you said, if we can have apparel options that help people be more active, that's what we're in it for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this has been just fantastic. I think we really covered it all, and I think this is just going to be great for the listeners. So many good topics that we've discussed today. So
Well,
thank
thanks for
you.
inviting me to participate.
Yes, thank you very much, Christy.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Moving Mindfully. I want to thank the College of Education at Washington State University for supporting this podcast. And I want to send a very special thank you to Maddie Roberts, my student who has been helping produce all of these initial episodes of the podcast. I could not have done this without her. Thanks to all of you for listening, until we meet again.